Good morning. The Kukua Council is going to court. The group says enough is enough. 3 years after a law to put care home reports online, the Department of Health is still not routinely posting. Board member Larry Geller details the reason for the lawsuit. And in a big week in national politics, news analyst Neil Conan weighs in on one convention's end and the start of another. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Surf photographer Zach Knoll has a history of being in the right place at the right time. He's with us to look back on his career and share his techniques. And the Maui Science Center is turning the heat way down so kids can build snowmen and igloos and maybe learn a little science along the way in a winter wonderland.
It's Tuesday, July 26th, and that's The Conversation, coming up after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We've been here before waiting for implementation of a law that was passed a few years back.
Yes, we have. And for a lot of people who are considering where they're going to be placing loved ones who need to be in a care home, not knowing how those care homes are rated, how they've come out in inspection has become a really difficult bone of contention. And we're going to talk about that this morning. Now, you would think that posting care home inspections online would have been easy. When the 2013 law passed, the Department of Health had an 18-month runway and funding for two positions to comply. But the DOH missed the deadline, and despite Governor Ige's strong support for the law, it has only intermittently posted the inspection reports, often heavily redacted. Yesterday, the Kukua Council took the matter to court. Board member and former president Larry Geller is in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, you know, for a lot of people, this is really a place where they could have gone to be able to find out whether or not a home that they were considering would be a place where they would feel confident in having their loved ones and knowing how that care home had been had come out during one of the recent inspections. And that was the whole point behind it. Now, you for a long time have been trying to get the state to comply. And this last, line that you had with a lawsuit wasn't something that you took lightly.
No, it was very much a last resort. We did this very reluctantly. We've tried everything. In October, we filed information requests to get reports and an inventory of homes. Didn't get it. The Kupuna Caucus also in October. That's a legislative group of legislators, seniors, and advocates. They wrote to the governor to get these reports posted. Didn't happen. Governor had told Civil Beat it would be resolved soon. Didn't happen. So finally, in December, we engaged an attorney to write a really good letter. And Lance Collins did write a letter asking for the reports. He pointed out at that time, let me give you an idea. The reports are supposed to be posted starting January 1, 2015. And there are of one category, the most critical one, the adult residential care homes. There are almost 500 of those, and only three reports had been posted for the entire year. So to be honest, we're wondering, were the inspections ever conducted? The only way to tell is to see the reports. And believe me, if you have to decide where to place a parent, a spouse, a grandparent, where they're going to effectively live possibly for many years, you want to know if that's an acceptable place or if they've had any violations.
Well, that was the whole point behind the law, because we are dealing with an aging population. A lot of families are being faced with this and simply cannot care for someone at home. Or there could even be someone who isn't even an elder, but someone who has been in an accident and needs to be in a care home. I mean, there could be many reasons for having to look for a place for someone. But when you were able to get some of the reports, they were heavily redacted. and redacted in the places that someone would just want to know, the findings.
Yeah, I wish I could hold these things up to the microphone so everybody could see. But
big black boxes, yeah.
Big black boxes. So you want to know if there's anything, any problem in the home, you get a report where it says findings, it's a black box. I feel for these families because if they've gone through the process of requesting these in writing, they've waited weeks for the report and they probably paid for them. And then they get something which has a black box.
Should they have paid for these reports, though?
No, at this point, not, we believe, because the law requires that they be provided for free on the web. Then the Department of Health should not be charging for them because the law says they're available for free.
Well, let's talk about the Department of Health. I mean, they've said, look, we don't have the resources to be able to do this, even though they were funded with two positions at the very start of it. And that resources, again, seems to be the reasons why at times these things could be done. Maybe they had a temporary person or they were able to fund it in part, but it's never been consistent, and that's been your problem with it.
Well, it's been less than consistent. There are a total of 1,702 facilities. So you expect that number of reports at minimum each year. And this year they've stopped entirely. They're not posting at all. The report is clear. You can't say, well, I don't have the resources. I'm not going to follow the law. It doesn't work for me as an individual. Why should it work for the Department of Health? People are counting on these reports. And what's even worse is they may be holding back the decision, waiting to get a report the hard way, the old way, where you had a request in writing. And to me, it's like you order a cheeseburger in a restaurant, you get the package, sit down, open it up, and find out that the meat has been redacted out of the cheeseburger. Is that still a cheeseburger? So are they providing reports at all if they're providing only a small fraction and those are redacted?
At one point, the Department of Health said that this was a matter of really understanding what the law meant by a completed report. What do you take that to mean?
I take it to mean they're trying to get out of the responsibility.
So it's obfuscating the issue.
Clearly. If someone who works for the Department of Health were in this situation, what kind of a report would they want? Would they want to argue? No, they want the report that was filed by the inspector or whoever did the report. And for nursing homes, this has been required by the federal government, and the Department of Health has been complying. The reports are clear. They're available to anybody freely online.
Has there been any more discussion with the governor? He seemed in such strong support of this as candidate Ige, and especially when he became governor Ige.
Along the way, there have been several requests to the governor. He said he would have it resolved. All we can say at this point, this is our reluctance. The governor can resolve this. The head of the Department of Health can resolve this, but it's not resolved. So let's see what happens now.
Meanwhile, what are you telling families who may be calling the council saying, we don't know what to do?
Well, if people ask us, we tell them what we're doing, which right now is we just filed a lawsuit. We're going to do the best to get these reports. Not just, as you said, not just for older people. Anyone could be involved in a traffic accident and need to be in a home temporarily to recover. And you want to know if there are any violations against that home because it's been in the news. People have died as a result of negligence in the homes. It's not very common. I'm not saying it is. But you don't want to wait till things progress to that point.
And the point seems to be that if homes are functioning well, that they would have nothing to hide. In fact, they'd like to promulgate the fact that they are a great place to have an elder or anyone who might need to be in a care home situation. But yet the care home industry has been strongly in opposition to this law.
Yes, they have. But you're absolutely right. A care home that passes all the inspections with gold stars ought to become a desirable location. It should be good for them and clearly good for the people looking for a placement.
Well, at this point, we're going to wait and see what happens next. Do you have any idea when this might come up in the docket?
No, not yet. I don't think it's been scheduled. We're looking also at the other aspects of protection for seniors.
Does this mean that this might not be the end of it for you, that you might have to take further action?
No. The Department of Health, we would like the Department of Health to do unannounced inspections. It's at their discretion to do so. They have declined. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office has been gutted, and actually the staff should be increased. So basically, particularly for seniors, but as we said, not just for seniors, the protections have been removed by the Department of Health that we expect our government to provide.
So I'm sure we'll be hearing more from the Kukua Council. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Larry Geller is a board member of the Kukua Council, which yesterday announced its lawsuit with the Department of Health. He's also the editor of the online blog Disappeared News. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, a studio visit from one of the world's most honored surf photographers. But first, test your knowledge in our backyard quiz.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaii.
While much of the state continues to pick up after this past weekend's tropical storm, today's quiz revisits a tempest that was even more destructive than Darby. When it came ashore in 1992, this storm caused more damage in Hawaii than any other hurricane or tropical storm since record-keeping began. The island of Kauai sustained the brunt of the damage, with almost 1,500 homes destroyed and another 5,000 damaged. The estimated damage total was about $1.8 billion, almost all of it on Kauai. The storm is also anecdotally created with destroying chicken coops across the island, whose former residents went on to dramatically increase the now infamous wild chicken population on Kauai. We're looking for the name of this Category 4 hurricane, and if you know the answer, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right will get the T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Akuchuk. My family is from Kaktovik, Alaska. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Zach Nall has seen surfing history made many times over and has captured it in images that have become part of the iconography of the sport down through the years. His craft requires a unique combination of skills. He'll be outlining them in an upcoming lecture. He's with us this morning to share some secrets. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
There's a sort of a collection of skills required to do what you do. What are they?
Definitely. I mean, being able to swim is a major one.
Yeah.
And I think just really working with light and exposure, and it's really about being comfortable in a heavy situation. What I'm doing is I'm shooting in the water, in these waves, in the most critical area to be able to bring these images back.
And vantage point is everything in this kind of photography, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, too far in or too far out and you're missing the photo. You need to be right in that sweet spot of the wave to be able to capture these images that you see in the magazines and all over.
Is a lot of trial and error go into finding that sweet spot?
Definitely. A lot of trial and error, and definitely being there mentally and physically. You know, you need to be in the moment and be aware of where you are and how the wave's breaking. It's really reading the wave and what's coming in and what's happening.
You're pretty much doing what the surfers are doing.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, we're watching it and trying to be right in that sweet spot, just as they are. And also being like a fly on the wall and being out of their way.
Well, yeah, that's my next question. How do you keep out of the way?
That's one of the major things. You know, you want to be there and record the moment, but you don't want to distract from their ride or take away from anything or their line that they're trying to draw.
Yeah.
So with that, you are trying to take the photo. They're not even looking at you, and they're trusting you that you're going to be out of the way.
And you're sort of trusting them to sort of go down the path that you expect them to. And that's kind of a lot of anticipation on your part.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, because I want to know that I can trust them when they're coming down. So it's a lot of surfers that I work with on a regular basis that I know that they can hold the line that they're coming, because I'm predicting where they're going to go as they're predicting where I'm going to go. And we're trying not to be on a collision course there.
So with somebody with a less experienced surfer, that would actually introduce a kind of a dangerous element, wouldn't it?
Definitely. I mean, with a less experienced surfer, you wouldn't want to be shooting with a wide-angle lens within a foot of their board. With a professional surfer, I'm in some of the biggest waves, shooting with a wide-angle lens within a foot of their, like, as their board, as they're coming flying by me, trying to capture that one moment. So it's a lot of trust, too.
That's nuts. I mean, I'm a foot away, that's incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, definitely.
But that's where the shot is.
Yes, that's the most critical and most exciting image to create.
Now, to do this, obviously, you need special equipment. And today's cameras can fire off a lot of shots per second, can't they?
Definitely. My new camera by Canon, it's a 14 frames per second. It's just insane. The quality, the image sensor, and it even shoots 4K video. So technology has come a long way.
4K video being the highest res that we've seen to date, right?
Definitely.
Which is, how far beyond the resolution of film is that, or is it more or less equal?
I don't know the exact, like, terminology on that for the how far along it is, but it is quite incredible. I mean, some of the top-line TVs are 4K TVs out right now, and that's the best resolution we have.
So with that many shots per second, you would be shooting at a pretty fast, a very fast shutter speed, right? Freezing every droplet of water.
Definitely. I mean, that's the main thing. I mean, that you want to push your shutter speed is to be able to freeze that water. It needs to be over a certain amount, which is about an 800th of a second, to be able to freeze water. Anything below, you're going to have a little bit of motion blur in your water. So it's something that is already very high, but also, like, it makes a difference.
Well, sometimes motion blur can be a creative element, but that's for a different kind of shot, isn't
Definitely,
it?
In a controlled environment, in a sense that you know that that's what your shot you're going for.
Yeah.
You can plan for it, you can stabilize, and also remember that we're always treading water in the water. So you're not putting a slow shutter and doing it on a tripod.
You're bouncing up and down.
Yes, and trying to hold that shot as still as possible to be able to freeze the action, at least, and have the wave blurred around it.
Which would mean almost like a disconnect between your arms and the rest of your body.
Definitely. You're almost like a little stabilizer with your arms, trying to stabilize that as you're moving up and down to tread water.
Have you ever used like a gyroscopic stabilizer?
No, I haven't used anything like that in the water. I mean, it's all just fins swimming and the camera in a housing, in a special water housing, and that's it.
And that works with a fast enough shutter speed.
That's what it does, yeah.
You know, the thing I've run into trying to teach photography is getting people to understand that balance between the shutter speed and the lens opening, right? Mm-hmm. That you're letting in a certain amount of light, and then there are different sort of relationships between them. You learned that from shooting film, right?
Right, correct. So when I first started, I was using little disposable cameras from the gas station, you know, film. Take them down to Long's and get it developed after I'd go shoot at Sandy's or someplace like that. And it really taught me a lot of just, you know, right from there, I went to a film SLR, the Canon 630. And so that really taught me a lot with the shutter speed, aperture, and you really just, it's a very harsh learning curve with film as opposed to digital. Digital, we're so lucky these days, and kids and people wanting to start out, you can see it right on the back of your camera.
Yeah.
Oh, that is way too overexposed. That's too dark. And with that, you're instantly learning and changing that. But I feel with film, it was a much harder learning curve in the beginning. But once you got it, it was really set.
It was an awful feeling to find out that you'd blown it 3 days after you
took the
picture.
Oh, yeah. That definitely happened the whole roll. You'd look and you'd be like, oh, that whole thing is too dark. So
yeah. But that kind of lesson really sinks in, doesn't it, Zach?
Definitely. Definitely makes you aware, you know, because it's so easy these days for someone to put it on, like, program or auto and just fire away and you're getting something great. But if you have, you know, when you're finessing it and you have it in manual and you can really see it is and create it straight from the camera, that's the most exciting part of it for me for photography is being able to create it straight from the camera, not in post-production.
You know, some of the new cameras, at least to my eyes, that seem to be too automatic, that they make it sort of difficult to do the manual override, which is, to me, where the real photography is.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, that's technology. I mean, my dad always told me the best camera you can have is the camera you have with you. And a lot of times that could be your iPhone in your pocket or your smartphone, whatever you have on you, because it doesn't matter if you have a $7,000 top-of-the-line Canon camera at home. If you don't have it and the moment happens right there, it's what is best is what you have with you.
You're making me feel guilty. I hope I don't see anything on my drive home.
You got your phone, right? So you're good.
But you've gotten good results with phones?
Yeah, definitely. So I've done four campaigns with Apple, and I've had billboards around the world, which has been a really cool and exciting thing to be able to see shot on my iPhone. I did a commercial, also a video commercial shot with my iPhone as well. So it's really opened my eyes to be able to see what is possible. You know what I mean? You're not limited to the best technology of those things. It's like this little phone is able to produce these giant billboards and top-of-the-line quality and color. So it's quite incredible world we live in.
It's really going to change the photography in the future a lot, isn't it?
Definitely.
Zach? Great talking to you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Zach Noyle is a surf photographer who holds a staff position at Surfer Magazine. He'll be a guest speaker at The Study at the Modern Honolulu on August 9th. The event is free and is part of the hotel's ongoing Study Hall lecture series.
Just because you have a movie star face and can talk doesn't mean you can sing. The dubbed-in voices of some of our most famous vocalists. They are real people, even if their biggest success is as a ghost. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Public radio is people. Our staff here in Hawaii, our broadcast colleagues across the nation and around the world, our more than 200 program sponsors, and our approximately 13,000 members. Thank you to this group of individuals whose donations provide for 65% of our annual budget. Among them are Elizabeth McNeil of Honolulu, Kelly Choate of Hilo, and Bert Martin of Kapa'au. As a listener, you're our kind of people, too. Let us hear from you in support of Hawaii Public Radio. An easy online membership form is at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thank you. Five years ago, a guilty plea to misdemeanor charges got Rod Tam a few nights in jail and over 300 hours of community service. Now all of that has wrought a change of heart and party as Rod Tam is back in the political scene and running for state senate. Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So Rod Tam is back. And, I mean, for a man who provided so much fodder for the Gridiron Show and just in general coverage, he seems to be kind of a different guy now.
He does. And this is coming from Denby Fawcett, who, as you know, longtime television reporter. She's now writing great columnist for Civil Beat. And this one, the one that's up on the site today, she interviews Rod Tam about why he is running again. You know, why we laughed so much at him over the years is because he supplied so much fodder from the things that he did. I'll just give you two examples. When he was in the legislature, he wanted government workers to have time off for naps, for napping, and for snacking. And then when he was in the council, he wanted to fine bus riders who smelled bad. Say what you will about Rod Tam, you know, he never ducked questions, even though his explanations might not be very satisfactory. But then, of course, he's used the term wetbacks when referring to undocumented workers taking construction jobs from Hawaii workers. He regrets that, but those are the kind of headlines that make you wonder, wow, this guy wants to come back into politics after all this time.
Well, you know, the wackiness aside, some of it had some, you know, practical basis. People should be eating and sleeping appropriately, yeah, to do their jobs, et cetera. And, you know, you kind of can wink your eye at that a little bit. Some of the other parts, especially that comment about wetbacks, not at all. But in wanting to take Suzanne Chun Oakland's seat, now that she says that she's not going to run, has there been anything substantial that has come from Rod Tam in why he wants back into politics, except to say he's a different guy?
Well, he doesn't have any regrets for what he did. And remember, he did serve time and two nights at OCCC. And why did he serve time? Well, he was misusing public and campaign funds. He was also fined thousands of dollars by the Ethics Commission for similar reasons. So those are serious infractions. But he blames it, by the way, on bad bookkeeping. But while in confinement, he said it gave him time to stop and to think, to slow down on what his true calling is. He even at one point compared himself to Mandela and Gandhi, who, as you know, were imprisoned as well for far different circumstances. But, you know, he also cared for his mom, who had Alzheimer's until her death a couple of years ago, and now taking care of his elderly dad. So he's had a lot of time to think about what his purpose is, and he feels he's got good name recognition. He's fed up with Democrats. That's why he switched to being a Republican. He's sick of raising taxes. He thinks we have an anti-business climate. So he thinks that, you know, this would give him a good heads up for Susie Chun Oakland's seat. Of course, the longtime Democrat stepping down.
All those things are issues that we've been talking about for a long time, some would say ad nauseum. But anything coming from him specifically that makes him you know, someone who might be able to take on those issues?
Don't underestimate him. You know, he did serve something like 25, 28 years, the House, the Senate, the City Council, even ran for mayor unsuccessfully. His record, by the way, is expunged. It's no longer on the books. But he will be taking on a formidable Democrat. It's either going to be Kim Koko Iwamoto or Carl Rhodes. There's another person in the running as well. Some people say maybe he switched parties so he wouldn't have to run as a Democrat and therefore lose in the primary. But, you know, he's out there campaigning already, putting up signs. And give him some credit. He does know how to win office. We'll see if he's successful this time.
You bet. It'll give us one more interesting race to be watching this campaign season. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, working to protect and manage Oahu's drinking water resources for life. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
Bombast and a bump in the polls mark the end of the Republican National Convention. The Democratic convocation began with a resignation and resentment after leaked emails revealed some chicanery behind the scenes in the primaries. A big week in politics on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan. He joins us now, as he does most Tuesdays, back on his Macnut farm on the Big Island. Welcome home.
Thanks, Beth Ann. I made it back just in time for Darby. But, you know, a little tropical storm seems like nothing compared to the heat wave back on the mainland.
And the political storms in Cleveland and Philadelphia, too. Let's pick up with the Republicans, who launched Donald Trump into the election campaign with some success.
Considerable success, if the polls are to be believed. Tied or narrowly ahead in the latest surveys, which I have to say surprises me. I thought the Republican convention in Cleveland came close to disaster at times and culminated in one of the longest and scariest acceptance speeches in American political history. The only real grace notes, I thought, were the speeches of Donald Trump's children, Ivanka in particular. And while they reflect very well on their father, the very next day, after his speech, Donald Trump revived attacks on his Republican rivals, even going back to those wild conspiracy theories about Ted Cruz's father and the Kennedy assassination. So we're right back to the candidate who's completely off message, who cannot let any slight go unanswered, and who's willing to say just about anything.
And infrequently does. Now, most conventions give their candidate a boost in public opinion. You reminded us that would likely happen. Does that explain these new polls?
Somewhat. But if you look at the numbers, I don't think it's so much that Trump surged. It's that Hillary Clinton's ratings went down. So she had a tough couple of weeks with her email story and 4 days of incessant attacks and all those chants of lock her up, I think, had an effect.
We heard those chants repeated by some angry Bernie Sanders supporters in Philadelphia yesterday, too.
We did. But before we get to that, just look at how these two parties are divided, each in their own way. The Republican base is solidly behind their candidate. There was very little dissension on the floor in Cleveland, and when it became clear that Ted Cruz would not endorse Donald Trump in his speech, even some of his delegates booed him off the stage. It's the party leaders who can't stand Trump, the Bushes, the Romneys. You can go through that long list on the Republican elite who refused to show up, John McCain, and John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who not only didn't attend his party's convention in his own state, but used some leftover campaign money to run some anti-Trump TV ads. So a candidate who's totally in tune with his base, and polls show that's very largely less well-educated white men, and detested by almost every elected official, every living Republican presidential nominee, with the exception of Bob Dole.
Neil, in the Democratic Party, it's almost the reverse with leadership seeming like its candidate is their favorite, and they like that candidate a lot better than a lot of the voters do.
Exactly. Yesterday, the convention was almost entirely devoted to placating the Sanders supporters. One speaker after another from the more liberal wing of the party, including Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders himself, all of them endorsing Hillary Clinton, and the Sanders diehards were not having any of it.
How much of this is attributable to those hacked emails from the Democratic National Committee that were published this past weekend by WikiLeaks?
They certainly didn't help, particularly the one email that suggested the party might want to plant questions in the media about Sanders as an atheist. But they didn't do that in the end. There was no real smoking gun there, but it all reinforced the belief by many Sanders supporters, the Bernie or bust crowd, that the party rigged the process and maybe even stole the nomination.
At one point yesterday, comedian Sarah Silverman, who has prominently been supporting Bernie Sanders, addressed that Bernie or bust crowd directly and flat out said they were being ridiculous.
And, I think that made a real difference. That remark would have been terribly patronizing if it came from the mouth of a Clinton supporter. But when she said that, the furor subsided a bit. I think the decision by Deputy Wasserman Schultz to resign helped. I think the appointment of Donna Brazile as temporary chair also helped. And she also issued an apology. Sanders' speech was moved to the star spot of the night. That helped, too. It did calm down somewhat. But there were hecklers during Elizabeth Warren's speech, and they were shouting, "We trusted you." So this is clearly not over by any means.
Okay, before we move on from the question of the emails, how much credence do you put into the reports that the DNC computers were hacked by the Russians and handed to WikiLeaks as Vladimir Putin's gift to Donald Trump?
Well, we have to keep going back to Dave Barry's old line this political year. You can't make this stuff up. I don't begin to know anything about the technical side of this, but people who do know that stuff say it's entirely credible. Now, Julian Assange, who's the founder of WikiLeaks, denies that it's the Russians. They deny it, but, they could have done it, and the timing was, precise as well.
And who knows, there could be more to come. This may be just the first batch made public, though. Yes.
And Wasserman Schultz may be just the first of the DNC officials to lose their job. One more thing. Those emails came out just a couple of days after Donald Trump told the New York Times that he would not automatically uphold Article 5 of the NATO treaty. That means he would not automatically support a NATO partner who was attacked. Now, this tended to get lost amid all the other provocative things Trump said last week. But this is tremendously important. It's one thing to tear up NAFTA or even the climate change agreement. But NATO has been the bedrock of U.S. and European security for 70 years, and Article 5 is the bedrock of NATO.
Which is another reason to look very, very carefully at what Trump is really saying. Now, okay, after all of this, did the emails and the dissension ruin the first night of the convention? Did they threaten to really spoil Hillary Clinton's hopes for a convention bounce of her own?
You know, despite all that mess, I thought the Democrats actually had a pretty good night. Cory Booker gave a terrific speech. I thought he really emerged as a national figure last night. And Michelle Obama's speech was even better than that. Somebody cracked it was so good, we'll probably hear it again at the Republican convention 4 years from now. I thought Bernie Sanders went a long way toward easing most of his supporters toward acceptance. And there's a new Pew poll out that shows 90% of the people who voted for Bernie Sanders are prepared to vote for Hillary Clinton. But we're going to have to see how that plays out. There's a lot of very angry Bernie delegates on the floor. They're going to be voicing their opinions in the roll call vote today. Some say they may even challenge Tim Kaine's nomination to be vice president. And especially we're going to have to see on Thursday how the candidate herself addresses these issues.
So what you're really saying is that last night might not have been the bridge over troubled waters.
Maybe not. But it was good to hear Al Franken cracking jokes for once.
All right. Thanks, Neil, and welcome home again.
You bet, Beth Ann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. Now on a backyard quiz, we're going to get back to another storm, the kind that we saw happen over this last weekend, but hyped up quite a bit more. Now, we asked you for the name of a Category 4 hurricane that hit Kauai in 1992, not all that long ago. This storm remains one of the most devastating on record, both in terms of the damage and physical characteristics. At the time, it caused $1.8 billion in damage, making it the third costliest Pacific hurricane on record. It even fatally damaged an 82-foot Coast Guard cutter moored at Naniwili Harbor. The official maximum sustained wind speed reported by the National Weather Service was 145 miles per hour, but a weather gauge at the U.S. Navy's Makaha Ridge Radar Station recorded an incredible gust at 227 miles per hour before being destroyed. The severity of devastation caused by the storm led to its name being retired from future use. Ironically, the name Iniki, a Hawaiian word meaning strong and piercing wind, and Hurricane Iniki is today's answer.
And
we had
Beth
someone
Ann,
who knew that?
Yes, Barbara Stanton of IAEA knew the answer to that. So congratulations, you'll be getting an HPR t-shirt. And at 8:47, that's our daily quiz. If you've got a quiz for us you'd like to hear on the radio, send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Kids seem to have a natural affinity for science when you show them how much fun it can be. Curiosity, of course, comes naturally to them, and if you can keep them supplied with phenomena to be curious about, the learning and the fun will never stop. With that idea in mind, the Maui Science Center is creating a winter environment where people can do what they never get to do here in Hawaii, build snowmen and igloos. Rima Murta is the director and founder of the Maui Science Center, and she's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Rima.
Good morning, Chris.
This is a nice idea. What made you come up with the idea to build igloos?
Oh, thank you so much. Just wanted to bring something unique, something unexpected, and bring some fun experience, and that also bring some learning twist to it. So Winter Wonderland in July, I thought it would be a great idea, especially on Maui.
How do you get the snow? You know, how do you create snow?
Well, it's not real snow, but what we're bringing is it's a special super absorbent polymer. Similar, but not exact the same, is used in diapers for little children. But it comes in a powder, in a white powder, and it, when you add a little bit of water, it expands 100 times its size.
Is this
it's really fluffy, really fun to touch.
So the texture gives you that similar feeling, that very moldable thing that snow gives you, huh?
Unfortunately, it's not much moldable, but we are still going to have some fun activities like building snowmen.
Uh-huh.
And because we're Science Center, we need to bring something something inventive when it comes to regular activity. So the snowman we will be building out of some household items like paper cups, and our big igloo will be engineered from recycled gallon jugs.
Uh-huh.
Jugs. So it would be something, like I said, it will be something unique. It's very fun for all ages.
What are some of the lessons you hope to pass along through this?
Oh, we would like to inspire curiosity. We would like to inspire play and thinking outside of box.
Mm-hmm.
Inspire questioning on everything. Science, it's pretty much all around us. And by questioning, by being curious, is how we learn. And especially when it's fun, it's easier for us to learn.
So sure.
An idea of Maui Science Center is break this intimidation when we talk about science or math or and technology. It's not just for play. It's for learning as well.
Well, you know, you mentioned intimidation, and I think that's an accurate description. But yet people who understand a little science, even just a little science or a little math, enjoy it very much. I mean, it's very enjoyable to make discoveries, right? So how do you think that intimidation factor comes about?
I think intimidation always, mostly comes from unknown. Many of us, we don't like being wrong, or we don't like something that is not easily explained. But with the Winter Wonderland event, or with any other events that Maui Science Center brings, we try to make it as simple as possible and easy.
Sure.
Easy-looking science that you can see at our events, go home, and try for yourself.
But, you know, for a scientist, the unknown doesn't make them uneasy. It's kind of what excites science, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
So how do you bring kids around to sort of celebrating the unknown instead of being intimidated by it?
I guess by bringing some surprising answers to their questions. Like we did show on air air pressure, and we explained some Bernoulli.
The Bernoulli effect.
Bernoulli effect, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And many, even adults and teachers, they were surprised how that explanation to this effect is much simpler than it is when it's presented in our textbooks. And so many kids, they would say, it looks like magic, but it's not magic. It's science. Show me more. Show me more. So I guess, bringing different approach to learning.
Well, it certainly sounds as if a different approach is warranted, because, as you said, if a simple explanation is actually teaches better than what's in the science book, there's something's wrong there, right?
Oh, not necessarily.
It's
not so much wrong. It's just in textbooks and schools, it's more of the facts and specifics and in the discipline. But when it comes to science centers and museum, it's all about informal learning, taking different approach to what's presented in school.
And that sounds like a goal that you have for the Maui Science Center, that you want to do. Is your emphasis kind of on what you describe as informal learning?
Yes, it's all informal learning. At first, we want to excite learners of all ages and show them that it's fun. And then with this fun, we want to mix in some serious learning, some serious disciplines. And not so much serious, but important, I guess, the science fundamentals.
How are your plans?
It has to be fun and make everyone welcome in the learning environment.
So I would guess you welcome the whole emphasis on STEM learning that we're seeing now.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Rima, thanks very much for talking with us this morning, and good luck with your plans.
Rima, thank you so much for having us.
Rima Murta is the director and founder of the Maui Science Center, whose Winter Wonderland event will be held this Saturday at the Maui Harbor Shops in Wailuku. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Bring your friends and ohana to HPR's annual fundraiser at the Palikū Theater on August 7th. This year featuring a world premiere double bill with Kuana Torres Kahele, and enjoy a group discount. Find out more about this limited offer at hawaiipublicradio.org/events. And please plan on joining us between shows for a mini luau, lei-making demonstration, and good conversation, and make your group reservation today.
You know, Neil Conan alluded to the fact that the Republican candidate makes so many shocking statements that you get numb after a while. But the statement he made about NATO and not necessarily honoring our treaty obligations was a major, as he said, a major, major shocker. It would mean a total reversal of a 70-year-old American policy.
And unfortunately, it was drowned out by so much other noise that, you know, perhaps a lot of people haven't been paying attention to that. But that what that would mean if we decide, well, we're not really going to defend an ally, what that would mean for the reputation of the United States and what our word is or isn't at this point would be very important for us to understand coming from this or any other candidate.
There's a phenomenon of a kind of a shock overload where you just sort of, you're so assailed by these things. The same thing is happening with the prevalence of mass shootings and you know, mass attacks. They're coming on a daily basis. And there's a real danger in feeling that kind of numbness, because you have to be sensitized to these things.
And trying to understand that the desensitization is happening whether you want it or not, and you have to actively pull against that and pay attention, even when you think, I really don't want to hear this again. But to understand what's truly being said, that was a lot of what Neil was trying to point our attention to this morning. And we'll continue to do that as we move further into this political campaign. And, of course, we will have more convention coverage for you today coming up at 2 o'clock on HPR 2 and then at 4 o'clock on HPR 1. Now, as part of the talking points of this campaign, we're hearing a lot about the potential effects of trade policies proposed by the U.S. presidential candidates. Tomorrow, Peterson Institute and Senior East-West Center Fellow Marcus Nolan is going to dissect some of those.
And we'll have a campaign to honor one of Hawaii's music heroes with his own postage stamps.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talk back line anytime you like. That's 808-792-8217.
Past shows can be found on the Conversation page under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.
On the next Fresh Air, the resignation of Fox News CEO Roger Ailes after several allegations of sexual harassment. We'll talk about how Ailes changed TV news, the allegations against him, and what his resignation means for the immediate and long-term future of the channel. Our guest will be Gabriel Sherman, the author of a book about Ailes. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
You're tuned to member-supported Hawaii.